You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 12th to the 18th of December 2013. My name is John Elms and I'll be filling in for our regular host Chris Parr this week. I'm joined today by news editor Simon Baker, writer Matthew Rice and editor John Gill. Last week's autumn statement provided a shock major news story for the sector with George Osborne's announcement of an end to the student number cap for England. The fallout from that announcement is covered in detail in this week's magazine and we'll hear on that in just a moment. There was no doubting, however, what the main international news story has been this week, with the passing of South Africa's first black president, Nelson Mandela, dominating the headlines. We have two articles this week covering the higher education sector's reflections on the man who led his country out of apartheid, and we'll be talking about that later on. We will also be covering Matthew's interview with the Master of St Bennet's Hall, Werner Jeanhon. But first, the government's decision to abolish the student number cap in England. We've got a couple of pieces on this. It's fair to say this was a surprise announcement, Simon.
Say it was a bolt out of the blue was probably underplaying it a little bit, to be honest. You do find with a lot of announcements of this kind that they get leaked, you get a hint of them coming up, there's some chatter around it. This did seem to come out of nowhere. Looking back a little bit, there seems to be a little bit of a clue in that David Willetts, around the time of the anniversary of the Robbins report in October, did write quite a detailed pamphlet about arguing for the need to expand the higher education sector. But did we think that they were going to suddenly get rid of the numbers cap? No, the reason being that all the news stories of the past few weeks have been about how business in having problems with its budget funding the current system. So if you've got lots of stories about how they can't fund the current system, how can they afford to suddenly get rid of the student numbers cap? And that seems to be one of the key questions. Our main article this week also looks at the kind of political infighting there has been since this announcement, because it's fair to say that the Russell Group haven't really welcomed this idea with open arms, because they're saying that, well, if there's a pressure on public finances, why are you giving this money towards expanding student numbers? You should be putting it into research, because obviously if you expand student numbers, it's not going to be the Russell Group that necessarily benefits. So yeah, it has been a shock announcement. It has lots of ramifications. There's questions about quality as well, how they'll safeguard quality now that this has happened. We explore that also in detail. And also a really fascinating parallel with Australia, where they actually did this a few years ago. There was a major report called the Bradley Review in Australia around 2008, I think. And that recommended that they should uncap demand to reach a tight target of really high participation. What Australia has found since then is that, there's been question marks about quality, about too many students getting in. There's now a review, basically, under the new coalition government because there are worries that it's unaffordable. There's some lessons there for this government, and there really is a huge question mark hanging about whether this can be afforded, really.
You mentioned this supposed flag flying in Willetts' pamphlet. If that was a flag, it was a very weedy flag. I don't think anyone actually noticed it. But, it really was a surprise, wasn't it? We were in a news meeting, I think, and came out, and this was during the autumn statement, this came out, and we were just absolutely shocked. And I think that really tells you, and obviously the Russell Group appear to have been shocked as well, hence this story we had this week where a Russell Group Vice Chancellor had quite what's reportedly quite a sharp exchange with David Willetts at a meeting behind closed doors, with Willetts being very, I think, antagonised that anyone would sort of put a negative spin on the sector being allowed sort of unfettered expansion, because obviously at face value that's a really good thing. Universities are allowed to offer places to the tens of thousands of qualified students who've been shut out previously. But the reason I think there are question marks, really this announcement asked as many questions as it answered, insofar as people just don't think it's properly funded. And if you're not, you haven't got a system that you really believe can be funded long term, it's very difficult perhaps for people to feel on safe ground with it. On the quality point, the small print of the autumn statement did go into that briefly. They said something like there will be. Well, you've got the quote there.
Yeah, no. Well, as you say, that after last week's announcement, what the government has said is that any institutions that plan to expand numbers at the expense of quality will have their places capped. But there are fears that academic standards, because of this uncapping of the student numbers, might slip.
Yeah, I mean, they said they reserve the right to reimpose caps on institutions which allow quality to be affected. I wonder if that's a kind of pressure valve in there against some of the private sector expansion that may take place. But certainly there's no indication yet what mechanisms they will introduce to allow them to do that.
It's not clear what they mean.
How quality assurance will be strengthened up, whether the QAA is the body to do it, whether there'll be some other route they go down. I mean, there's lots and lots of questions to be answered. So all those sort of, all the minutiae that we've been reporting on over the last couple of years about student number controls and AAB and core and margin and so on, we'll just have to shift now to the reporting the minutiae of exactly how quality controls will be imposed and all that, and how this will be funded. I mean, we're actually, as we speak, Patricia Hodge is... Patricia Hodge? Margaret Hodge?
Yes, Margaret Hodge.
As we speak, Margaret Hodge is at the Public Accounts Committee really taking to task some of the officials involved in this, and her suggestion to them very much has been, look, you haven't given us a coherent funding model here. The sale of the loans book just won't cut it. And that's a question that really the government needs to answer quite seriously.
I mean, I can only think of two sort of answers to that, really. Either the government have announced this knowing that whoever wins the election, they've got to redesign this system, whoever it is. They've got to think about their loan thresholds and find a way that means it is more affordable in the long term. So you might as well uncap the system because someone's going to have to make it sustainable anyway. Either that, or they've seen now 3 years of constant criticism of the system and about how it's unsustainable and how in the long term the government's not going to be able to fund it. At the end of the day, has it gone wider than just the people in the sector talking about it and us talking about it? Do voters really care? Do they think that, you know, this is a ticking time bomb? No, they don't. Politically, it is not something that is going to cost anyone the election. It's clear. It's never really become a huge issue because it's not going to happen for about 30 years. So, you know, I think on that basis, that they thought, well, this can't do us any harm. It can only win us some kind of a positive, or win us votes, really.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, our two articles in this week's magazine do go into these points, which we've already covered in even greater depth, so don't forget to check those out. I mean, as you mentioned, John, this was you came out of a news meeting and you were suddenly met with this announcement, and then the following day,
I mean, it's one of those weeks, isn't it? It does happen as journalists that often it's like buses. You know, major news stories will come along in threes, and it was one of those weeks. The third story, of course, being the ongoing student protests
as we speak
again, primarily at the University of London, but also Sussex and elsewhere. I mean, it's one of those weeks where there's been an awful lot to report on. Mandela, obviously, is it's not a higher education story. It's something that's been reported at great length globally, but certainly, you know, a large part of Mandela's story and the sort of rebuilding of South Africa, there was a strong education element to that. We've got a piece this week in which David Matthews talks about the academic boycott that went on, and also in less detail about the little known fact perhaps that Nelson Mandela lost out in a race to become Chancellor of the University of London, coming in third place behind Princess Anne and Jack Jones, former General Secretary of the Transport and General Workers Union. So,
I know that was a long time ago, but it was an interesting sort of kind of juxtaposition between that and the protests going on. I wonder what Mandela would have made of that.
Well, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But, I mean, we also have a piece this week by Martin Hall, which is fascinating, actually. I mean, Martin Hall, Vice-Chancellor of Salford now, he's British citizen. He certainly grew up here and went to school here, but he went to do his PhD in South Africa and stayed there for many years, and was latterly, I believe, Deputy Vice-Chancellor at the University of Cape Town. And he tells a story in the opinion he's written for us this week about being invited to Mandela's home after the end of Mandela's presidency, when he actually asked a bunch of professors from Cape Town to come and critique his presidency and tell him what he'd done right, what he'd done wrong, you know, some of the challenges that remained and how he could best approach them. And it's just extraordinary that a man of Mandela's stature would be asking academics in the local university to come in and kind of, you know, provide that evidence-based critique. It's the sort of thing you can hardly imagine Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or David Cameron doing, is it? But a great man, and obviously somebody who had a real bearing on higher education, not only in South Africa but elsewhere too.
Quine, what are the chances of that University of London election repeating the same results?
Yeah, as we say, it's easy in hindsight. I suppose this was 1981. You think Jack Jones, as a sort of trade union leader, it just seems bizarre that he would beat Nelson Mandela. But I suppose different times, and
he was a pretty well known figure at the time.
At the time, certainly.
Yeah. Yes, David's piece. We cover the opinions of Mary Stuart, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Lincoln, and Chris Brink, the Vice Chancellor of Newcastle University, who both have strong connections with South Africa, and they provided some very personal insights, as does Martin Hall's account of when he met Mandela and all that the great leader of South Africa did for higher education. Moving on to Matthew, slightly less media furore about this piece, but no less important.
Can't understand why.
I can't understand why either. You interviewed the master of St. Bennet's Hall, Werner Jeanhorn, and he is, I believe, the first lay master of this institution. And what is the significance of that?
Well, it's a very curious institution which probably could only exist at Oxford or Cambridge. It's technically a permanent private hall. It's a Catholic foundation, but in many ways it's a college in all but name. They have about 50 undergraduates there studying not the full range of subjects, but quite a wide range. But it is also a monastic institution. There are 6 monks there living full time, and at the formal dinners, not only do they have Latin grace, but they have readings from the Rule of St. Benedict. So it therefore has some rather curious status. For example, there is a mechanism by which the some of the money from the richer Oxford colleges can get transferred to the poorer ones for building work and so on. But the permanent private halls, this isn't. They can't access this money. And since this was a monastic institution, solely monastic institution until the 1970s. All the alumni of the hall are, of course, have taken vows of poverty, so they're not a very likely source of funds. And the
I'll remember that next time I get a begging letter from my university. I've taken a vow of poverty.
Give me a financial model for all.
Yes, indeed. And the other thing is the new master, who's a very distinguished Catholic theologian, very much at the sort of progressive end of the Catholic spectrum, would love to admit women to the college, like to the hall, like all the other Oxford colleges. But because it's also a monastic institution, canon law doesn't allow it. So they're going to have to find, you know, put in a new building, partly just to get round this law, which must date back to the 14th century or something. So they're all. It's a very curious kind of institution. He's clearly a very dynamic, forward-looking man with wide intellectual interest, and so the challenge is to take this institution, which, you know, if you visit it, must seem pretty odd, into the 21st century and make it a major source of intellectual debate and, you know, a college with students of exactly the same standards as all the other colleges.
Mm. There probably was a time when having the patronage of monastic patronage was exactly what you wanted. They had all the money, but things have changed somewhat. So,
yes, I mean, in some ways, as he said to me, it is returning to the sort of most ancient idea of the university, where you sat right where it was monks sitting around the master. But and it's now the master and his wife, of course. And some people love it. He's told me, which seems very plausible, and I'm sure it's also there are many students who would not want to go there, but it is very curious and interesting.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, and the curiosity is one to check out in this week's edition. Besides all that we've covered in today's broadcast, don't forget our cover feature, which we haven't even mentioned yet, is by Stephen Rose and his attack on Neuromania. If you are frowning at this, this is the big claims being made about how neuroscience might improve teaching. But Stephen Rose argues that the contributions neuroscience and neuroscientists might make to educational practice are often overstated. There are a number of serious misunderstandings about educationists, among educationists, sorry, about what neuroscience can and cannot contribute. So don't forget to check out our cover feature. Keep an eye on our podcast page on Friday the 13th of December. The latest in our series of books podcasts will be out, featuring books editor Karen Shook in conversation with Durham Professor of Classics Barbara Graziosi, author of this week's Book of the Week, The Gods of Olympus. Also, remember that we're all over the social media platforms that there are to offer. Follow us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. Search for us on LinkedIn, Facebook and Google+. Until then, that's all from the THE Issue Review. Thank you and goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.